right now, it's time for History Matters. Taking a look back at this week in history with the one and only Scott Washington, historian extraordinaire, who joins us here in the studio now. How are you?
Until they have cloning, then there may be several of me.
So, right. Which would probably be helpful.
That will be one of those historic things we'll have several of us note.
Can they clone your background knowledge as well as the question? Or
that's
are the clones going to be like born and then have to learn everything?
In,
yeah. Send in the clones. Very nice. Yeah.
Well,
I feel bad. That took me a second.
Sorry.
I'm usually much more on the ball, but I've been on the air for 2.5 hours. I'm losing it, Scott.
Can't be fun. Well, it's because I'm thinking about the moon this week. This is the week that 49 years ago when Apollo 11 took off and landed on the moon.
Good.
And had the first steps, which I just think is an extraordinary technological achievement. 1969, they take off on Monday, July 16th, and then they land 4 days later on July 21st. The interesting thing, now I did not know this, that one of the experiments they wanted to find out is to find out how accurate their estimations were for the moon being away from the distance between the moon and the planet Earth. Mm-hmm. And they actually put a reflector on the moon so they could shine, you know, see
oh,
the
so
speed
they
of light,
can, like,
measure
get the speed
light.
Of light, yeah.
That's right, and actually found that it was 131.2 feet farther away than previously believed.
Well, from that location, I mean, if they had put it on a hill, it would have been exactly right.
You know, somebody didn't introduce that. Yeah, hey, what about this? But this was also a week when also the first Martian Viking 1 landed.
Yes, yeah.
On Mars, and which was kind of extraordinary too. So,
yeah.
You know, these are the things that I kind of find interesting.
You know, okay, so here's the thought that just ran through my head. Next year is going to be the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. Every time I think of the moon landing, I think of the movie Dumb and Dumber, that scene where Jim Carrey looks at the thing and is like, ah, we landed on the moon. That movie came out in 1994, so we are now as far away from the release of Dumb and Dumber as Dumb and Dumber was from the actual moon landing.
That is hilarious.
I don't know what to make of that, but that just occurred to me now.
Coincidence? I think not.
We landed on the moon!
We did! Also, on Monday, that's when the rocket takes off, but it should be noted that on that day, July 16th, 1945, is when the first atomic blast took place.
Yep.
Now, this was not the ones in Japan. This was the test. And there was a real concern, like, you know, would it, you know, wreck the atmosphere? But they had to test it. It was detonated in Alamogordo, New Mexico, visible 180 miles away, equivalent to 15,000 tons of TNT. Mm-hmm. And let's remember that at that point it was to try to shorten the war.
Yes.
Not necessarily create the most destructive.
So this is the question that I don't know. Was that known generally when it happened, or when the bomb was actually dropped on Hiroshima? Was that like the first public announcement? Did other countries know? Did Japan know that the U.S. had successfully tested this?
I don't think so. I think that's what I think they warned them that there was a surrender, but Japan just ignored that.
And, yeah. And if they had been aware, I don't.
But Truman was just aware of the
high
cost.
Who knew what at the time?
In the Pacific, the high cost of taking islands. The idea that. Yeah, the sheer manpower that be involved in taking Japan would be daunting.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Well, that just ushered in a whole new age.
Yeah.
And that's why I note it, and I think we should note it, because we're still in those shadows, and yet there has been a lot of de-escalation of nuclear weapons since, and thankfully, but at the same time,
We still have a long way to go.
Yeah.
It is really fascinating to think about the difference between 1945 and today in terms of military surveillance, right?
Yes.
Because if someone, like now we've got satellites covering the
everywhere.
World, so if anything like this happens anywhere, presumably it would be public knowledge at some point, but that was certainly not the case 73 years ago. So,
no, and I think but that's why it's good that we have lots of communication, a lot of people watching all the time, all the time to make sure that there are no accidental...
With some occasional downsides to everyone watching everyone all the time. But,
well,
you know.
That's huge.
Little you know,
oh, yes. I'm watching you right now.
It's got some pros and cons.
but with the radio, you can turn it on and keep it on to a great station like WCHL.
Yes.
Where
no alternatives.
That's right.
That's it. That's all you can do.
But here's something else that happens on the, I think it's actually kind of noteworthy. In 1975, this is on, again, July 16th, the first species was removed from the endangered species list, which was enacted in 1969. This is just some years later, and it was three species of trout. And so those who would say, oh, we don't need regulations, well, it really was because we can completely fish out a river. That is important. We don't always know what the diversity does, but we know it's important to life.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
And we could take steps to maximize the survival of nature long term.
And sometimes intentional planning is a good thing, like 1790. The District of Columbia is established as the capital of the United States after the signature of was called the Residence Act, which an act provided for national capital and permanent seat. And people think that we've always had Washington, D.C. Not so, actually. There was Philadelphia and New York, and then they said we've got to have somewhere, so what becomes the District of Columbia is what's established. But what I did not know was that George Washington was so involved in actually determining the exact location and hiring a surveyor. I thought that was just kind of really unusual to think
about.
If you're
going to have a city named after you, you want to make sure they do it right, I think.
Yes, I would think so. But that's pretty cool. Also on that date is the first air conditioner. Now, we can really be happy. 1902.
Yeah.
It's installed in Brooklyn, New York, and invented by a fellow, William Willis Carrier, who went on to found the Carrier Corporation. We hear of, Carrier air conditioning. Yeah. But that's amazing to think about, with the continued global climate change, how important things are like heating and cooling to us now.
How interesting is it that the first air conditioner is installed in New York City? Like, on the one hand, you would think, okay, yes, New York City, capital of, economic capital of the world, everything starts there. So, first air conditioner. There are hotter places than Brooklyn. I know it gets hot in Brooklyn, but it gets hotter elsewhere.
Yes. You think Florida?
One would think.
California.
Yeah.
But I think probably at that point it was somebody tinkering around, having the materials, having the ability. But you're right. Of all the places.
Yeah. And I've lived up in that neck of the woods. So I know how. Yeah. And I've lived up in that neck of the woods in a house that did not have air conditioners.
Yes.
I know how important it is to have an air conditioner in New York, New Jersey.
Oh, it's very important.
You can't not have one down here anymore.
No, that's right.
Which unfortunately is incorrect. There are people even down here now who live without air conditioners. But the fact that it's, I looked at that and it's like Brooklyn, New York. It's like, I would have thought New Orleans or Miami or something.
Well, yeah. I'm sure they quickly adopted that.
They quickly adopted it.
In fact, I think last week we were talking about, there was an article, I don't know if we got to it, about a refrigerated pool, about the only one here in America that was done because the water got too warm, so they decided to do something different.
All right.
It just shows that technology is a big part of history, too. 1969, July 17th, is when the New York Times actually issues an apology for a 1920 article ridiculing a theory that rockets could function in the vacuum of space. And this came on the successful launch of Apollo 11 on the way to the moon.
The day before.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
Yep.
Somebody said maybe they would have had to apologize.
Oh, God. That one I got right away. Sending the clones took me a second.
And I don't know what it is today.
I feel like the New York Times, if they were going to issue an apology for something they said 45 years ago, there were 10 previous, or not all of the, not all of, like, many previous space flights.
Yes.
They could have issued this apology in 1957.
That's right.
Or 1960-61
exactly.
When the U.S. got on board.
I think
they waited until
69.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad at least they were, the astronauts were headed for the moon. They actually arrived there. But here's a fella who did not. He's a stunt pilot from Galveston, Texas, mm-hmm. and he gained notoriety on July 17, 1938. His name is Douglas Corrigan, and he was fascinated by flight and certainly Charles Lindbergh's flight. So he flies to New York, and he wants to get permission to fly across the Atlantic. And they look at this kid who's, I think, probably about 18 or 19, and they say, no, you can't do it. So he takes off. He says he only has a compass, gets lost in the clouds, and then realizes at some point, oops, I've taken a wrong turn.
Oh, gosh.
And he ends up flying across the Atlantic. And it's called, he gets the nickname of Wrong Way Corrigan.
Yeah.
His entire life, he always swears that it was not, it was a mistake. It wasn't intentional. But
oh, you remember earlier when I said that it was a mistake? What I actually meant to say was that it wasn't a mistake.
Wait a minute. This sounds really familiar, like really contemporary. The last couple of days, I keep hearing this.
Right.
Okay, well, there's a couple other things happening.
So let's talk about yesterday in history, which is the 100th birthday of Nelson Mandela. He was born in 1918.
Yes.
Jumping ahead to Wednesday, and we had Barack Obama's speech earlier this week in recognition of Nelson Mandela, but particularly important historical celebration this year because it's his 100th anniversary.
That's right, and it's astonishing how he goes to prison for that long a period of time. And comes out not bitter, but better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just an astonishing story in how he led a divided country into a new era that continues to have ripple effects. And we need to be associated with great, great individuals like that.
Yep.
Lift them up.
Speaking with Scott Washington, History Matters, taking a look back at this week in history. What else you got?
Okay. There's one that I thought was really kind of interesting. And I did not realize that it went this long. It's July 20th, 1813, when representatives from North Carolina and South Carolina met near the present-day town of Tryon to figure out where the state boundaries were between these states. And what's fascinating is that, yes, the colonies had divided in 1712, but no official boundary was specified.
Right,
can you imagine? Okay, we're breaking the egg in half, but we're not going to really
say.
It's kind of there somewhere.
Yeah.
And it goes on.
This
so
gets
they,
really, really convenient when tax day comes along and when South Carolina comes.
It's
you're like,
crazy.
No, I live in North Carolina.
Oh, my gosh. And the people living right near here, it's been just horrific because they've had different surveys, 1735, 1737, the 35th parallel, 1750, 1764, and on and on and on. And finally, it goes into the 21st century.
Oh, yeah. This just wrapped up like a few years ago, didn't it? I think
2016.
I was here. I remember when that happened.
I mean, that's just astonishing to think that it went from the 18th century to the 21st century, and nobody could really figure out where was the boundary was.
Well, there
that could
are
divide.
Parts of land around that border that I don't think anyone wants. Like,
but still, I think that's still an issue for some of the residents who have land that's in one state and land in the other as a result of this final determination that they're still trying to work its way through some kind of resolution.
There are parts of that area that no one wants, and then both sides are claiming Carowinds, I'm sure.
But it's something about the issues of where boundaries are and how that's so important to determine nowadays. But, you know, you go back enough in time, it was very vague. And that's why when people do DNA testing and they find themselves, I've got relatives here and there and all over the place, it's because migration was going on. You had drought. You had famine. You did not have the kind of nation states that we do today.
Well, that's also really fascinating because, like, nowadays we've got the surveying. We finally, in 2016, resolved what that border was and what's North Carolina, what's South Carolina.
With lasers and everything.
Right. But the state boundary doesn't matter nearly as much now as it did back when this fight was first going on, when North Carolina and South Carolina and Virginia, Massachusetts, et cetera, really thought of themselves almost as a lot more independent than they do today, less as we get into the 19th century, but still to a degree. And those state boundaries actually mattered to more significant degree than they do today, and yet they didn't even know what the boundary was.
Well, in that area, around the North-South Carolina border, there is a lot of rural areas, so it's not necessarily one that people jumped up and said, oh, we've got to claim that commercially. And it just kind of languished, an afterthought.
No one tried to make South Carolina pay for the wall.
No, that's right. Yeah, exactly. No wall necessary.
As it turns out.
But the free migration of people across the United States is a great thing.
It's huge, and
that's also true in Europe with the European Union.
Yep.
Same kind of thing. That has worked well.
And I think that's sort of an underappreciated aspect of American history, the extent to which we did things, and I think the interstate highway system is the one that I always point to. It's like the thing that we did to encourage the migration and the ability of people to get from one part of the country to another really went a long way towards forming to a degree, unified national culture.
That's right. Yeah. Well, and history is very much...
Again, for better or worse.
You're right, because history is very much the movement of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that has changed people's lives in a significant way, and cultures. And it's been usually a very good thing. So, in fact, it seems appropriate that this week we would have the birthday on July 22nd, 1849, poet named Emma Lazarus.
Emma Lazarus, yeah.
And she is the one who wrote the poem that helped raise money to build the pedestal for the Statue of Liberty that someone climbed on the 4th of July.
Yes, right.
It was interesting seeing the Statue of Liberty in the news on the 4th of July, trumping everything else that day. But that's a great poem. And, you know, I think it's appropriate. We should read that at least once. We should have poetry on this. But those who wondered about it, it was written in 1883 to raise money for the construction of the pedestal, and then the poem was engraved on a bronze plaque and mounted inside the pedestal's lower level. And it goes like this. It's very short. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gate shall stand a mighty woman with a torch whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beaconed hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient land, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Great words.
Yeah. It's a sonnet, too. I didn't realize that until very recently.
Isn't that interesting?
Literary device there.
Well, it just shows that so many people responded to this fundraising appeal because they could trace their own family heritage to people who had immigrated here.
And speaking of great women in history, got to mention that today, the 19th, is the 170th anniversary. Am I doing the math right? Yeah. 1848 of the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention in New York, which was the beginning of the modern women's rights movement.
That's right. Yep. Oh, that's really significant.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so glad you mentioned that. I missed that somehow when I was putting together my notes, so I'm glad. This is why it's so good. We always are like, really, this happened today? This happened this week? And that's what keeps me excited. There's also one on the 22nd. Now, not quite in the same league, but a woman named Floretta McClutchin, born in 1888, and she's considered the greatest woman bowler of all time. But now here's the interesting thing. She had never held a bowling ball until she was 33. She bowled 10 perfect games of 300 points.
Wow. I never broke 200, and I
that's pretty
bowled
amazing.
Quite a bit,
just,
actually.
Just like, wow. Quite.
I'll
you
do
know,
that.
Just to show you that there's many different ways that people have talents and abilities, and those are good things.
There you go. History matters, as always. Scott Washington, I got to wrap up, but thank you
That's
so
good.
Much.
That's all right. Keep bowling.